It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later this hour, I'll be talking live with Iowa State Medical Director and Epidemiologist Dr. Caitlin Pedotti. I'll be talking about what we know and don't know about the dangers of vaping, with the dozens of e-cigarette users dying in the country, many more, over 1,500 sickened. We'll have a local view on that worrying development with e-cigarettes and e-cigarette users. Also, a new poll from Grinnell College shows Americans are open to alternatives to prison for nonviolent offenders. I'll talk with Logan Lee of Grinnell College about criminal justice polling and how some attitudes that may surprise you have changed here in the U.S. But first, meet my religious neighbor. That's the name of a project that encourages understanding between Des Moines' unique faith communities. This half hour, we want to find out more about the project, what it's doing to foster relationships between faith groups, and explore some of the religious diversity of the Des Moines area. Joining us to do that in our Des Moines studio, Tim Knepper is director of the Comparison Project at Drake University. He'll tell us in a moment what that project is all about. Sarah Trone Garriott is coordinator of interfaith engagement in at the Des Moines Area Religious Council. She's also a Lutheran minister. Connie Wilson is a member of the local Baha'i community. We'll find out about that as well. And Imam Jaffer is with us, Imam Jaffer of the Muslim Community Organization in Des Moines, connected with the An-Nur Mosque in Des Moines. Thanks to all of you for making it into the studio on this, it is melting, but snowy day.
Thank you for
You're
having
so
us.
Welcome.
Let's talk with Tim. Let me start with you, director of the Comparison Project at Drake University. Give us a little backstory here. What is the Comparison Project, and how did it result in Meet My Religious Neighbor?
Okay. Do we have a couple hours?
No.
Comparison Project started about 8 years ago as a lecture and dialogue series in comparative religion, hence the name Comparison Project. We published some academic volumes through that series and hosted a number of events for folks from the community. About a year into the project, though, we started working a lot with local lived religion in Des Moines, teaching classes at Drake about religions of Des Moines. Through that project, we had the opportunity to create a student-written photo narrative about religion in Des Moines, focusing on 15 religious communities called A Spectrum of Faith. That sells as a fundraiser for the Des Moines Area Council's Food Pantry Network, hence the connection there. But coming out of the Spectrum of Faith book launch, we wanted to do more in getting folks into all the wonderful religious sites around Des Moines. So out of that Spectrum of Faith project, we launched Meet My Religious Neighbor, which is a monthly open house series. A religious community throughout Des Moines takes turn hosting the event once a month.
Mm, okay. And give us an idea of the length and breadth of and the diversity of the Des Moines area community, religious community. How many religions are represented there, did you find?
It depends how you quantify religions, I suppose. A lot. We've done, I think, 24 of these events. Just to give you some idea in terms of Buddhist temples, there's probably a good 10. One facet of a diversity that always amazes me is Orthodox Christian churches. I think I count about 6 of them. We have the Greek, the Russian, Serbian, Coptic, and also Eritrean, so I guess only 5. Plenty of mosques, Hindu groups continuing to find not just the Hindu temple in Madrid, but smaller groups that practice in homes. There's a lot, a lot of religious diversity in Des Moines.
Okay, let's get around to the other guests because they represent some of the religious diversity we find in the Des Moines area. Imam Jaffer of the Muslim Community Organization in Des Moines with the An-Nur Mosque. Tell us, how have you and your mosque, your followers, been involved in this project?
Yeah, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to also express and to share what we have and our contribution to this project. The project has been a good means and tool for us to also contribute to the religious understanding in Des Moines. We have been cooperating with them And one of the things that we've been doing, we contributed to the project, is that we had the understanding that having our doors open to our neighbors will help us understand each other, and will help people that don't know much about Islam or the Muslim community. They will get to know us more, and we'll also get to know them more. So one of the things that we did in September, on September 14th, 2019, we had an open house where people, our neighbors and people that didn't know much about us came to see what we do. We introduce our mosque, we introduce Islam to them, and we introduce our activities, and we get to know them more. So this has been our contribution towards this project. And also, in addition to that, from time to time, our friend and our brother, Tim, he always brings students to our mosque to learn about the religion. And we have been having good rapport and effective relationship with them. All that is contributing to the religious understanding in the Muslim, in the Des Moines community. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the things that we are also doing in order to contribute to the success of the program.
Imam Jaffer, I'm sure you'll agree it's a challenging time for the Muslim community around the world and in this country. When you open your doors and invite other faiths in to learn about your faith, what are the chief misconceptions you find yourself having to talk about and correct?
Yeah, some of the things that misconceptions that we find, main ones are two from our community members. Some of them, because they are refugees, and they come here with some kind of mindset about the American people. They think that Americans don't have good perception about Islam. They think Muslims are bad. So our community, our members, they feel when you want to interact with people that are not Muslims, they may not accept them. So our members, they feel they are not welcomed. So they are not well involved in the community. They feel isolated. And they have that scare. They don't know whether they are accepted by the community or no. At the same time, our neighbors and American people too, sometimes because of what media portray about Islam, it makes people have a bad perception about us. So these are the challenges that we try to, these are the gap that we have, and we're trying to bridge between our community and the non-Muslims. We feel we need to work together in order to bring understanding among us, so that those who are not Muslims should understand, to know the real and the true Muslims, what we do and what we don't do. And people that do bad things in the name of the religion, they should know that this is not part of the religion, it's not part of Islam. At the same time, our members too, they should also feel that they are part of the community, so that they also get involved in the community and feel free to work with our neighbors and our friends, so that we will all have a better place to live together as human beings.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Meet My Religious Neighbor is the name of a project that we're exploring this half hour, encouraging understanding between the various parts of Des Moines' unique faith community. Go over to Sarah Trone Garriott, coordinator of the Interfaith Engagement at the Des Moines Area Religious Council, also a Lutheran minister. Tell us about your focus. I understand you are focused on the youth.
Well, in my role at Des Moines Area Religious Council, we value relationships. And so one of the reasons why we participate in this interfaith learning is that we couldn't do our work without lots and lots of diverse partners, different groups of people working together. And so I have the opportunity to do a lot with young people. We have an interfaith youth leadership camp each and every summer. We've done this for the past 3 years, and we'll be having another camp coming up on July 2020. And then throughout the year, I continue to work with young people. We'll go out into the community and do presentations, panels. We do a lot of relationship building between different religious communities, and the young people are a really great place to start. they're very open to exploring and learning about their neighbors, and it gets them thinking about their own religious practices and community and beliefs and helps them to reflect on that.
I wonder if when you compare the generations, when you're working with the youth, if you find the youth of the Des Moines area more tolerant, more accepting of diversity in faith than perhaps a generation or two older, your generation, for instance.
Well, I think that we had this opportunity to work with the youth, and the camp model has been really exciting for folks. And I've found that even the adults that we tell about the camp, that the parents that send their children to the camp, the faith leaders who get to watch their young people come to the camp, they get very excited about interfaith work, too. And so we've had a number of adults say to us, we want a camp for us. We want a camp for adults. And so I feel like across the generations, there's a lot of interest, but there is something great about watching the young people do it, and that really inspires the older folks in the community to say, I could do that too.
Mm-hmm. Connie Wilson, you're a member of the local, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Baha'i community. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Very good. What is Baha'i? What are its origins?
The Baha'i faith is a young religion. It started in 1844, was founded by Baha'u'llah. One of the foundational beliefs of the faith is that throughout time, God, and we believe that there's one God, has sent different manifestations or different messengers throughout time, because time changes and we have different needs and we need different solutions. So God has sent these messengers throughout time, including Abraham, Moses, Buddha, Krishna, Jesus Christ, Muhammad, and Baha'u'llah, we believe, is the most recent, with a message for the time. We've been really fortunate for the last 2 years. We've been celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birthday of the Bab, who was a man who came and said that Baha'u'llah would be coming to found the faith. And so these 2 years of celebration just culminated last night, and that's how we became a part of the Meet My Religious Neighbor celebration. And it was a wonderful opportunity for us to teach people who were very interested in learning about other religions a little bit about the Baha'i faith, because it is very new and very few, you know, people know about it.
How many people showed up?
125 people showed up. We packed the Windsor Heights Community Center, and it was the most wonderful group of people. And I was telling Tim, his Drake students who were there representing the project were open and they were interested, and it really gave me hope for the future, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Connie, your background is interesting, coming to the Baha'i faith, because I understand you were raised by a Christian minister, your father.
I was raised by a Methodist minister who's listening to this right now.
Okay, so we don't have much time, but we're sure interested in why you gravitated to the Baha'i faith from your Christian upbringings.
Frankly, I love Jesus. I love the Christian faith. Like I said, I acknowledge all the faiths. And one of the things that appealed to me about the Baha'i faith was that in order to become a Baha'i, I didn't have to say all religions were wrong. And I was right. I acknowledged the validity of all of them. And my father, over time, has listened to that. We have lots of interesting conversations, and he respects my decision.
Mm-hmm. Tim Knepper, let me turn to you ask how you measure the effectiveness. I mean, we can hear anecdotes like we just heard, and we're hearing it sounds like a very good program to promote tolerance, diversity, and an awareness of our diverse religious landscape. But how else are you measuring the effectiveness of this?
That's a good question. My grants officer wants to know. I'm a philosopher by training. You know, philosophers don't think so much in terms of measuring, quantifying, qualifying, so forth. We do measure in terms of the number of people who come out, first of all. As Connie said, 125 on Monday of this week, and for Masjid An-Nur, Imam Jafar's community, I believe we had over 200? Over 200 come in. Some of the other events are smaller. They happen during normally scheduled worship services. They happen on a Sunday morning when a lot of people in Des Moines, frankly, are in church. So not always do we see those numbers. But we do see transformations. I see those most of all in my students and the growth of my students over a year. And we see them as well in the work that Sarah and I do with the Interfaith Youth Camp. A lot of transformation happening there as these campers are spending a whole week with each other, with campers of other faiths and forming tight bonds and friendships.
Let me put a little finer point on my question about measuring the effectiveness or reaching your goal of greater tolerance and awareness about our religious communities. It seems to me you could say, okay, the people coming to these events are probably already very tolerant people when it comes to other belief systems. But the most important group to connect with are the people who are less tolerant of other beliefs. Do you have examples, Tim, or the others there in our Des Moines studio of breaking through there, making a, I'll just say, conversion, so to speak, of someone from the less tolerant side to the more tolerant side of faiths?
This is Sarah. Well, I think that even if people are in theory tolerant, they might not have relationships with folks who are coming from different religious backgrounds than them. And so actually getting to know people, having relationships. So one example I like to give from when I was in the parish, I had a class that I did a couple years ago with folks from the Sikh community. And one of the young men who presented, J.J. Kapoor, is pretty well known in our community. And he came and talked to the group, and they were mostly older adults. And these older women, for weeks afterwards, were coming up to me and saying, "Oh, Pastor Sarah, J.J. won a speech contest. I cut the article out of the newspaper. Oh, Pastor Sarah, I saw J.J. was on the news last night." None of them had met a Sikh before J.J. came to visit, and they all had a crush on him. And so when you have those relationships, it really makes a difference that you can really live out that openness and welcome that you wouldn't in another way. And then that impacts your community that you live in. So from the camp this past year, I know we've had some unique friendships develop. One of our more evangelical Christian campers is now good friends with one of the young Sikh women from the camp. We had a young woman from Gilbert High School. She's starting an interfaith group at her high school, which didn't exist before. So those are signs that we're having impact.
I wonder too, if part of the battle, part of the challenge that you all see here is and Imam Jafar mentioned this earlier, is countering some of the mainstream popular media narratives in our news. Do you see that, you know, seeing someone on television, a report about someone on television is much different than meeting them face-to-face in your neighborhood, right, Tim?
Indeed. Is this a question for me or for the imam?
Well, anybody, yeah. Anybody can toss it.
Yeah, we see this through the Interfaith Camp. I see this in the work that I do with the Interfaith student groups at Drake, and we certainly see it and meet my religious neighbor as well. There was one young man who came in to the mosque who talked with me briefly for that first visit and had never been there before. And really, I could see and hear in speaking to him how his eyes were being opened.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is Imam Jafar.
Yes, Imam.
In addition to what Brother Tim mentioned, the day that we had the open house, it was amazing. I'll give you two examples of things that make you understand that such programs are very, very important. There's a small group of, a small organization on University Avenue. I may not be able to mention their name because they didn't allow me, they didn't give me permission to do that. Mm-hmm. Their leader came, he attended. This is what he told me. He said, that was the first time he met a Muslim. He, in his entire life, he heard about Muslim, but this is the time that he saw Muslim, and he has been passing by that mosque, and he never knew what that building was meant for. So it gave him opportunity to get to know about us, and then he told me that that has changed so many things about his perception that he used to think that he hear from the news, from the media. And us, from our end, to me, myself, I was so amazed to see the number of people that attended. And that showed to us how our neighbors care about us. And we didn't even know that if we have something, people can come to us like this. So that these two scenarios show how effective this program is.
Mm-hmm. Tim Knepper, we're coming up on the end of our time. I wanted to get this question in because you probably saw a recent Pew poll about the decline of Christianity in the U.S., declining in terms of the total numbers here in the U.S. Those who are religiously unaffiliated have grown in the meantime. 26% of Americans, according to this Pew poll, describe their religious identity as unaffiliated, so atheist, agnostic, or in the words of the question, nothing in particular. Are they part of this discussion?
They should be. They're certainly invited. And I do want to do a visit in the future with the local atheist, agnostic, and freethinker group. We've had students work with them before. Mm-hmm. I'm friends with members of that community. And there's certainly a place in my heart and in my scholarship as well for what I think of as atheistic forms of religion. Mm-hmm. That there are beginning and will continue to be new modalities of religiosity involving humanistic, secular, and atheistic varieties.
Sarah, you do a lot of work with facilitating, providing support for religious groups in the Des Moines area. With some of these smaller communities, religious communities, perhaps newer communities to Iowa, what are some of the needs you hear expressed and try to meet?
Well, I've had communities reach out to me for space. I do a lot of things in my work that are other duties as assigned. I've had groups say, well, we need a place to meet. Does anyone have space they can share? We're looking for a building to purchase. And so I'll try to help make connections between existing religious communities that have space and they can host and, you know, make those connections. So that's a need. But then also just trying to help connect folks to the resources that are out there. Folks often gravitate towards religious communities when they're needing help. And our food pantry network has a lot of resources. And so just trying to make sure that those religious communities know what's available in the community already so they're not trying to start from scratch or reinvent the wheel.
Mm-hmm. Tim Knepper, quickly before we go, we have just a few seconds. It sounds like you have a great track record here of increasing awareness and tolerance in religious diversity. What are the plans for the future? How do you want to grow this?
Thanks for the question. It is exhausting, and I do want to thank Sarah again, thank DMARC, and also thank two groups that aren't here, Cultural and the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa. Meet My Religious Neighbor is now a partnership with all four, and they're helping me out in ways that I can't do this myself. As far as the future goes, how about this Faith Fest downtown after the farmers market on a Saturday to be able to reach some of the people who wouldn't normally come to Meet My Religious Neighbor?
Hey, I'd go to that. That sounds like fun. All right. Thank you very much for coming into our studio. Tim Knepper, Sarah Trone Garriott, Connie Wilson, and Imam Jaffer, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about the hazards of vaping with the state medical director and epidemiologist, Dr. Caitlin Padotti. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we just heard in our news, the House of Representatives, bitterly divided along partisan lines, voted today to endorse the Democratic-led impeachment inquiry into the president. Tomorrow on this program, a programming note, we're due to have the 3rd District Congresswoman Cindy Axne on this program. The first half hour, we invite you to send your questions in advance for 3rd District Congresswoman Cindy Axne, who will be on this program. That's the schedule, live tomorrow. Send your questions to this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Mysterious lung injuries have killed dozens of e-cigarette users and sickened over 1,500 across the country. Let's get an informed Iowa perspective on this alarming development by turning to Dr. Caitlin Padotti, our state medical director and epidemiologist. Dr. Padotti, welcome to the program. Dr. Padotti, are you there? Okay, Dr. Padotti, evidently not there at the moment. We'll try to get that fixed up. I'll just mention in the meantime that in reaction to this alarming news, more than half a dozen states have adopted or considered bans on certain e-cigarette products. The Trump administration has considered a ban on flavored vaping. Our governor, Kim Reynolds, does not plan to sign an executive order banning vaping at this time. I think that's due to some court considerations there, it being challenged in court. The Iowa Attorney General, though, Tom Miller, with some interesting reaction here. Perhaps you saw that in the Des Moines Register this week. He wrote to federal officials this month to say that banning commercial vaping products for adults would harm public health. He fears that restrictions and bans on vaping and flavored e-cigarette products could lead people to return to smoking traditional cigarettes. Dr. Caitlin Padotti, I think, is with us now. Sorry about that technical hiccup. Our state epidemiologist, Dr. Padotti, welcome.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Okay. We have to hurry up a little bit. We lost a couple of minutes there. What can you tell us about the number of people affected by e-cigarettes in Iowa? I stated at the beginning the dozens of e-cigarette users, the deaths across the country, 1,500 or more being sickened. What's the picture here in Iowa?
Yeah. So far we've had 43 reports of persons here in Iowa who've experienced respiratory illness related to vaping. We've not yet had any reported deaths, although as you mentioned, there have been over 1,500 cases nationally and other deaths reported in other states.
Mm-hmm. What are the symptoms?
Yeah, so there's a variety of ways that people are presenting. Sometimes it starts a little bit, we would say, non-specifically. So with things like feeling tired, maybe having a fever. Some people are reporting some gastrointestinal symptoms, things like abdominal pain, nausea, or vomiting. But what seems to happen is everybody progresses to having difficulty breathing, coughing, respiratory symptoms. And for some people, those symptoms are becoming bad enough that they're requiring help breathing in a hospital.
Mm. I'm sure you're aware, we had in our news that not too long ago, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, the CDC, mobilizing 140 scientists and other staffers to investigate the causes of vaping-related lung injuries and deaths. From your perspective, what are the biggest unanswered questions about these vaping-related lung injuries?
Yeah, so this is exactly the type of work that public health is meant to do. You know, when something new or unusual emerges, one of the things that we try and do is work together to gather more information so that we can better understand these things and ideally prevent them from happening. And so that's exactly what we're trying to do. Now, with anything that's new or emerging, it can be tough when we don't have all the answers. And it can be frustrating, you know, for us and for everybody, you know, who's experiencing this. And so this is a sort of complicated outbreak because, as you've noted, there's a variety of products and devices that people are reporting in association with these illnesses. And so it's been hard to understand if there's a single cause. And in fact, it's possible that what we've detected is actually going to end up representing a spectrum of illnesses that could have more than one cause.
Mm-hmm. So from what we know, what is happening in terms of damage to the lungs, do we know? Or is that really a big question mark?
That's another great question that we don't have a lot of information on. And it's another reason why we're asking our clinical partners and public health partners to report these cases, because we don't know what the long-term effects of these products are. And so, again, part of what we're trying to do is come up with more information on how to follow these patients over time and how to better understand what those health effects are so that we can share them and inform the public.
Okay. In the meantime, until we have more research and results there, what message do you want to get out to e-cigarette users, also youth and their parents, because a lot of these e-cigarettes are in the hands of minors?
Yeah, you know, because we don't know the exact cause of this outbreak, if people are concerned, the safest thing to do is to avoid these products altogether at this point. But anybody who's been using vaping or e-cigarette products and becomes sick should seek health care. We want our health care providers to be asking people about the use of these products, and we'd like them to report suspected cases to us at the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Mm-hmm. If you have the choice, if you say, I have to smoke, I have to get my nicotine, a traditional cigarette or an e-cigarette, do you know which is better now, the lesser of the two evils there?
Yeah, you know, again, I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking. And this is an example of a time when really from a public health and clinical perspective, of course, the best thing to do would be to not use any of those products. Right now, people who want to quit, which is a great thing, should work with their healthcare providers, their pharmacists, you know, to come up with a way that will work for them using some of the FDA-approved devices. And that would be our recommendation at this point.
We have about 1 minute left to Dr. Pedotti. Flu season upon us, of course. Tell us very quickly, what does this flu season look like from your vantage point in the Midwest?
Yeah, you know, we're still currently at the sporadic level here in the state of Iowa, but there are other states that have seen the activity increase around the country, even up to a regional or widespread. And so this is really the time that people want to be thinking about getting their flu shots. Ideally, you want to do that a couple of weeks before you'd be exposed. So we're just encouraging everybody 6 months and older to take advantage of that preventive tool to keep themselves safe and healthy this season.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about this year's vaccine? How many strains is it covering?
Yeah, so there were a couple of adjustments to this year's vaccine, and typically you'll see available either a tri- or quadrivalent vaccine, either three or four viruses. They're going to include a couple of flavors, so to speak, to cover both A and B type viruses. And a few adjustments were made to better match what we saw last year. But again, you know, the ideal thing to do here is to make sure that you're taking advantage of that flu vaccine and protecting yourselves and your loved ones.
Mm-hmm. About 30 seconds left. Are there any risks of getting a flu shot? Some people wonder about that and forego a flu shot.
Yeah, you know, just like anything, there are always some risks associated with, you know, vaccines and a shot in general. But thankfully, those risks are few and far between. The most common thing that people might experience would be a little bit of soreness or redness at the vaccine site, and maybe a little bit of a low-grade temperature. Those are actually okay. They mean that your system is responding to the antigens and you're mounting an immune response that's going to protect yourself. But anybody who's curious should always work with their healthcare provider or pharmacist to learn more and make sure that they're taking advantage of this good preventive tool.
Dr. Caitlin Pedotti, State Medical Director and Epidemiologist. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Across the country and here in Iowa, we've had decades of tough-on-crimes policies, and as a result, our prison populations have risen. Now, a new Grinnell College national poll indicates Americans are open to reforms that would divert nonviolent offenders from prison. Joining us to talk about these poll results, Logan Lee, assistant professor of economics at Grinnell College. We had the director of this poll in yesterday, Peter Hansen. Logan Lee, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
I understand you helped write some of these questions on criminal justice for the poll. So let's talk about, before we get to the questions and the results, ask you to talk about what you set out to do in this polling regarding criminal justice reform.
So our goal was to better understand what kind of policies people support in terms of reducing incarceration and just the overall thoughts about why we incarcerate people to begin with. Mm-hmm. This is an important question just because there seems to be broad support for reducing mass incarceration. That's something that most people are in support of. But there haven't been a lot of polls that look specifically at, okay, how do we do that?
Mm-hmm. So what questions did you come up with?
So we asked two questions. The first one just went through a list of four different potential policies that we think are important and potentially viable strategies for reducing mass incarceration, and just asked people whether they, you know, thought that was a good idea or not, the extent to which they supported them.
Mm-hmm.
So the four questions that we asked, the four policies that we suggested, were sending nonviolent offenders to programs other than prisons. So that would be things like drug courts, home arrest, using GPS tracking, that kind of thing. We asked about reducing sentences for first-time violent offenders. We asked about requiring judges to regularly review prisoners who've already been sentenced and then release any who have been deemed to be rehabilitated. And we asked about stopping the practice of sending people who are currently on parole back to prison for just minor technical violations, things that wouldn't actually be considered a new crime.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find?
So we found that there was a lot of support across all of the potential policies except for reducing sentences for first-time violent offenders. That was only around, you know, in the mid-30s, whereas the others were all in the sort of two-thirds or above range.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying the deciding factor here was that it's key that these people are non-violent offenders.
Yeah, that seems to be the takeaway for sure. People are worried. And the second question we asked actually was very consistent with that finding as well. The most common reason people suggested why we should lock up prisoners is just to get them off the streets, basically make us safer. And so I think this fear of violent criminals is driving a lot of the resistance to reducing sentences for that group.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about what these poll results tell us about the type of criminal justice reform that would be most accepted by the public.
So yeah, I think the thing that was most popular was these alternatives to prison. And increasingly with better technology, these are becoming more viable. Electronic monitoring in particular is something that's been quite popular. Both in our poll and it's actually being implemented in some states. And it seems to be a way to, you know, still get some of that protection in the sense that you are limiting movement and those kind of things, although not as strongly as if you just go straight to incapacitation, actually incarcerate someone. But it's going to be lower cost. It's going to be less disruptive to the individuals. Often they can still keep their job. And so this was a really popular thing, but again, only for the nonviolent offenders.
Mm-hmm. How do you hope these results will be used? I suppose you hope that lawmakers and especially will take notice.
Absolutely. And one of the big takeaways for me from this poll was that when you break out our results based on whether the voters voted for President Trump in the 2016 election, mm-hmm. you see almost no difference in the patterns of responses. And that was unique across all of the poll questions. Almost every response to our poll questions, if you supported President Trump, you thought one thing, and if you didn't support President Trump, you thought something else. This didn't show that pattern at all. And so that shows me that there really is this broad bipartisan support for these kind of, I guess, common sense reforms. And that's exciting, right? In a world of a lot of partisanship, that there might actually be real progress to be made here.
Mm-hmm. Have you received any specific feedback? It only came out yesterday. Feedback about this part of the poll on criminal justice yet?
Not too much from politicians or that kind of thing. In my own research, I work really closely with the Iowa Department of Corrections,
mm-hmm.
And they were excited about the poll. They were excited to see some criminal justice questions being asked. They are a group that really wants to get offenders rehabilitated so they don't return to prison. They would love it if we incarcerated fewer people. And so I've talked to them some, and they were encouraged, I think, mm-hmm. by the results.
How does these poll results contribute to the national conversation about criminal justice reform?
So I think the context of the national conversation in criminal justice reform right now centers around the First Step Act that was passed about a year ago. That bill did some good things, but it only did it at the federal level. And that the federal government actually incarcerates very few people. Mm-hmm. So to make real strides, we need to make progress at the state level. We need every state basically to implement some of these broad form policies. And if you really want to end mass incarceration, unfortunately, we may have to move the needle some on this violent offender issue. Even if we released every prisoner in the United States who is not a violent offender tomorrow, we would still have an incarceration rate that's about three times as high as Europe or Canada or a lot of the rest of the developed world.
Mm-hmm. Are there grades of violent offenders? Do they come in different categories and maybe look at the, I don't know if would you call them low-level violent offenders, or do you grade them?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, right? So there's everything from murder at the high end to, kind of lower level assaults, particularly assaults that are not domestic violence related. And one thing to keep in mind with these violent crimes is that often they end up being crimes of passion. And we find that violent criminals are among the least likely to commit new offenses once they've been released. I was a juror actually in Oregon. This is the story that I'm always reminded of. And I was a juror on a case where a man had, on his way home after a long day of work, seen his wife kissing his neighbor in the front yard. And he hit them then with his car. He ran them over, and he was convicted of 2 counts of attempted murder. He is a violent criminal. That was a horrible thing to do. But it's also, you know, he's also not a person that's likely to commit a lot more violent crimes in the future. He just made a really bad decision in the moment. And so those are the people who maybe don't need to be locked up for 20 years, right? They can serve shorter sentences potentially, and that could really reduce incarceration. Mm-hmm. Because if we're locking people up, we're spending a lot of taxpayer money. There's all kinds of other negative consequences for families and et cetera. And we might not be buying a lot of safety in those cases.
You mentioned, Logan, the First Step Act, the federal First Step Act. Mm-hmm. Remind us what that was about.
So the First Step Act did a number of things. Probably the most important thing from my perspective is that it increased the amount of earned time prisoners could get. So this is a policy where basically for good behavior, if you participate in programming that we think is rehabilitative, if you just keep your nose clean and avoid misconducts, you can actually get out of your get out of incarceration earlier than the official end of your sentence date. And so this bill both made it easier to get that earned time and increase the maximum amount of earned time that a prisoner could earn. And then it did a number of other interesting things, too. It decreased racial sentencing disparities. So we used to have very different penalties for things like crack and cocaine, even though they're the same drug. So it sort of fixed that. And it required prisoners to be incarcerated within 500 miles of their families, or at least where they live. In hopes of encouraging things like prison visitation.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned at the outset, Logan, we all know that our prisons have been filling up because of these get-tough policies on crime here. Mm-hmm. We were in a different mindset decades ago. Remind us how we got to where we are today with our prisons so filled. Wasn't it public attitudes that prompted these get-tough-on-crime policies that filled up our prisons? How did the attitudes change?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the 80s and even maybe a little bit before, you had this big push for the war on drugs, right? And we started incarcerating lots and lots of people for all kinds of reasons, and there was this big push to get tough on crime. And again, the goal was to make us safer. The goal was to have less crime. And I think what's happened over time is that we've recognized that through all that incarceration, we haven't actually bought that much less crime. Violent crime rates have fallen over time, but it doesn't seem to be directly related to the higher incarceration rates. It seems like that's happening for other reasons. And so I think the public is realizing that this policy that seemed like a good idea just hasn't been working, mm-hmm. partly because of the criminogenic effects of incarceration itself. Just going to prison, it looks like makes you more likely to commit future crimes.
It's opposite of rehabilitation.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, problems like that, I think the public are sort of recognizing this and looking for different solutions.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, with your area of expertise, your research focusing on prisoners' responses to policy changes, also reducing recidivism rates, can we look to other countries? I mean, we know the United States incarcerates such a large percentage of our population compared to any other country, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We are the highest incarceration rate in the world, excuse me. And certainly we can look to other countries to some extent for inspiration. We need to be careful, though, because culture really matters here. And there are just a ton of differences between the U.S. and, say, Sweden and Norway. The Scandinavian countries have some of the lowest incarceration rates and also have just really nice prisons where it's not quite so punitive when you go there. It is much more focused on rehabilitation. But it's difficult to say that just picking up Norwegian prisons and putting them in the U.S. would solve our problem because it's a much more complicated system than that, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Very quickly, before we go, on this poll, you've got all these results now. Do these results in this latest new Grinnell College National Poll on Criminal Justice open up, prompt further questions in your mind that you might want to poll about in the future?
Absolutely. I think in particular, the second question we asked that tried to get at why do we send people to prison to begin with, 44% of our respondents said that it was just to prevent additional crimes. And I would love to dig into that a little bit more, whether that is just fear largely driving that, whether people were actually thinking – you know, this isn't why we should send people. It's just why we do it. And there also, we had an other category that had some really interesting responses about, you know, private prison systems, just, you know, that it's basically a money-making scheme, which it isn't really in the big picture. Private prisons are a very small fraction of prisons overall. But just understanding a little better how people feel about why we incarcerate to begin with, I think that's going to be really important as we think about policy moving forward.
Okay. Logan Lee helped write questions about criminal justice for a new Grinnell College national poll just out this week. Logan is an assistant professor of economics at Grinnell College. Thanks for joining us, Logan.
Thanks so much for having me.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.